NTU World of Wisdom. Welcome to High Impact Thesis. In this podcast, we speak with researchers from various scientific fields to talk about the motivation, goal, and potential impact of their research. We also want to give you a sense of how a PhD is carried out with an emphasis on the PH, the philosophical aspects involved in pursuing a PhD.
Welcome back to the HIP podcast, everyone. Today we have a very familiar voice. We have Christopher with us. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Your hosts today are Malik and
Abu Bakr.
Great. So, Christopher, we're going to ask you a little bit about the podcast towards the end, seeing as you're one of the founders, one of the three founders. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, can you just give us like the broadest overview of your research area?
Hello, everybody. I'm Christopher, and from Malawi, and I came here to do space physics research. My research is broadly in the field of space weather prediction. So the same way that you have weather here on the ground, you talk about it might rain and the temperature and so forth. There is analogous weather in space, and one specific parameter that my work was looking at is ionospheric density. Okay. So I'd say that's the broad version of it.
Right. So ionospheric density.
Yes.
So let's just take that apart.
Yeah.
What is the ionosphere?
Right. So for most planets that are habitable, okay, right now we really only know of Earth. It has this protective layer, which is something that traps the energy, or at least some of the energy that's coming from the sun. So the ionosphere itself is just a layer of charged particles. So it's a plasma layer. So you've got neutral oxygen atoms and nitrogen atoms and some oxygen molecules, and you've got the energy from the sun that ionizes those, and that forms a layer. In this layer, we call the ionosphere. And so on the day side, the ionosphere has a different structure than on the night side, right? Because, you know, on the day side, you've got a lot more sun and therefore a lot more energy. And so it's denser generally, and it's closer to the surface of the Earth. On the night side, the density is lower, and also the actual starting point of this plasma layer is slightly higher. Right? So this is the ionosphere. Right now, you know, it's mostly seen as one of the things that protects us or allows for life to happen on this planet, you know, because if that energy were to reach us, it would cause a bit of things frying, fried. Let's just say not good things. So it's one of the protectors. You
know. Right. How high are we talking?
Oh yeah. So in the night, we're talking above 100. Kilometers or sometimes 200, and then during the day it gets to around 80 kilometers. And this ionosphere is usually stratified or put into, you assign labels to different layers depending on the density. So we say D layer, E layer, F layer. This is starting from the bottom. D is closest to the surface, so lower density, and then higher density. And the F layer is the highest density region.
And this layer is formed as a result of the sunlight coming in?
Yes. So as a result of the sunlight, that is the electromagnetic energy, but also because of what are called... what we call the solar wind, which is a collection of particles protons and those kinds of things. These are moving at very high speed, right? So they come and they can collide with a molecule or an atom and ionize it. So you get both. You get the particles, physical particles, and then you've got the electromagnetic energy. Those two things are what ionizes the ionosphere. There are also other cosmic particles from around the cosmos that are moving at a very high speed, and those also ionize the ionosphere. Ionize neutral molecules and atoms to form the ionosphere.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. So you mentioned there was a density gradient.
Yeah.
Right. So what is the significance, or what are the implications of this density on the rest of the planet?
So in day-to-day life, you and I, maybe we don't know yet if there is any impact, right? But because it is a conductor, right? So often what we look at is how that can modify other currents. So as you know, if you've got a current in a wire, it creates a magnetic field, right? It doesn't create it, there is a magnetic field. So when you have current in a wire, there is a magnetic field around. And as you know, the Earth itself has a magnetic field, right? So when you have these particles from the sun, or this extra energy from the sun, it comes, it modifies the ionosphere, and that modifies the currents, and those currents modify the magnetic field of the Earth. And those modifications you and I can feel either through the systems that we have. In really bad cases, for example, the variations in the magnetic field can induce currents in pipes that are carrying, you know, oil or electricity lines, for example. So in really bad cases, it can destroy things, you know, because these are variations, you know, variations in magnetic fields. They induce an EMF, and then that EMF, of course, if it's not planned for, can cause problems. So the density itself, maybe you and I don't feel it directly, but there is a cascade of events that we can feel and our systems can be affected by. Yeah.
So the ionosphere, the density, does it decimate or does it just shift around? So in parts of the day, so the ionosphere just shifts over there, and parts of the night, basically, elements of there go shift over there.
Well, actually, you can think that it shifts, but essentially it's the sun, right? So you have the Earth, and as the sun is moving, well, actually the Earth is moving, right? So you have the sun that is fixed, and as the Earth is moving around, right?
On its own axis.
Spinning on its own axis. It exposes different parts of itself to the sun, right? Mm-hmm. So the part that is exposed the most directly to the sun, that is the day side, right? That side will have a higher density than the other side. So the ionosphere itself doesn't move per se, but as you can see, as showing different parts of it, it will be, from a different reference point, you can say that it does indeed move, right? So yeah, the densest region is moving with the rotation of the Earth on its axis.
Is it right to believe like the net density would be the same across the planet? So somewhere it's high, somewhere it's low. They just cancel off?
Roughly, yes. Across a particular day, the density is about the same, as in the total density, right? If you do the night side and the day side. I'm not sure what value that metric has, because in general we kind of studied them differently.
So what in places where there's a midnight sun, so the sun coverage throughout the night as well, so do you expect the ionosphere density to be high throughout the time?
I can't speak directly to those regions because there are still some things that are not yet clear, right? So this picture I've given you about the day side having higher density, for example, is true. But there are a lot of other things to do with latitude, for example, that mean that the picture is not so straightforward, right? So in the regions that, for example, are up north, right, or closer to the poles, you know, the dynamics are a bit different. And so for sure, when there is more sun, there is more energy, but you've got the magnetic field, the way that it's configured there is different than at the equator, and that then creates a structure that is a bit more complex than just more sun equals denser. Yeah.
So you said the ionosphere affects the magnetic field of the Earth.
Yes.
We also know that the iron core has or generates the magnetic field as well, right?
Yes.
So how do these two kind of play together?
Yes, so actually I mentioned that when you've got these variations in the magnetic field that are caused by, say, an increase of energy from the sun, so that creates a magnetic field. A current is the one that creates a magnetic field, right? And that magnetic field interacts with the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is the one that you're talking about that is always there because of... That's the current understanding. It's not crystal clear how the Earth's magnetic field is there, but we know that it has to do something... at least the scientists believe it has something to do with the core inside. So that magnetic field is the one that you and I feel. That's the one that people have been using for navigation for centuries. So that magnetic field can interact with the magnetic field that is generated due to these variations in the energy input from the sun, right? So if you have a magnetometer here, for example, it's always, of course, measuring the Earth's magnetic field. When you have these variations because of the energy from the sun, you will be able to see those variations. Right? So it acts in a way as a tool to measure what we call geomagnetic disturbances, okay, the geomagnetic storms and these kinds of things.
Right. Yeah. So I'm guessing this is that a field of research where you want to know what's going on, and then you correlate it with the rest of the stuff that's going on the planet.
With some of this stuff, because it's still a pretty new field. So there's some correlation studies that make sense and some correlation studies that are kind of forced. What we know is that, you know, more energy has an impact on density. That's something we can explain. What we also know is that because we understand enough about Faraday's laws of induction and so forth, that if there is a current and that current will produce a magnetic field, and then we can do some math around predicting what variations we can expect. But there isn't really extensive studies in terms of how will the grid be affected and so forth, right? Or a more controversial topic is whether you and I are affected by that directly, for example, right? Because it just seems that there's so many things that would make it hard to say if it's because of the ionosphere or because of the moon or whatever, right? So we don't, at least in my work, I didn't do a lot of correlation studies. Like, why does that event happen, you know, with some correlation value against that event? I didn't really do that.
Right. So you were more in the prediction phase, right?
Yes. So the specific area that I was interested in is to look at signals that are coming from satellites to the ground that cross the ionosphere. So if you think about GPS, for example, you are transmitting at around just a little over 1 gigahertz. And this signal, it crosses the ionosphere and it is affected by the ionosphere, you know, because ionosphere is charged particles. And as you know, electromagnetic wave does affect a charged particle and vice versa. In other words, the charge affects the electromagnetic wave. So my work is looking at just one aspect of the ionosphere, which is density, right? There are other aspects. There is the temperature, for example. There is the composition, like I just talked about oxygen molecules and atoms and nitrogen. That's still something worth studying, but for me it was more about the density of the ions. So these density irregularities often are regions that you can think of as holes, you know? If you have a table like this, a hole would be a region that has different density from the surrounding, right? So in the case of in everyday life, a hole usually has just air, for example. But when you think about it, it means that the surrounding region has higher density than that area of the hole, right? So when an electromagnetic wave goes through such a region that contains these holes, it is affected. So my work was looking at, one, if I take a picture of the ionosphere, can I identify these holes, okay, or these irregularities? So taking a picture of the ionosphere, you do it using an antenna system. We call it an ionosonde, this piece of instrument that's putting out an electromagnetic wave of roughly 1 megahertz to 20 megahertz, right? So as you can imagine, that's very low frequency, and so the antenna has to be massive, right? So these are very tall antennas, very tall because they need to be high out off the surface. So what you do is it's like a radar unit, right? You put out a signal, you get back a response, and you analyze that response with your algorithms to tell you about the density of the ionosphere. Okay, so that gives you a map of height versus frequency. Okay, so we call this ionogram. Okay, so the x-axis is the frequency, which is the frequency that I'm sending out using this instrument that we're calling the ionosonde. And then on the y-axis is the height, okay? Because when you send a signal to the ionosphere, depending on the frequency of the signal, it'll be reflected at different points. So it'll be reflected at a point where the density is such that it can no longer go through, okay? If you go beyond a certain frequency, the ionosphere is transparent to the signal, so you cannot hear back, so to say. So for example, we've talked about GPS, it's above 1 gigahertz, so that just goes through, you know, it's not reflected. But when you send up a signal of say 2 megahertz, it will be reflected. So where it is reflected will tell you about the density, okay? So for example, 2 megahertz would be reflected at, let's say, 80 kilometers, while as 8 megahertz signal will be reflected at, say, 250 kilometers. Then you know that at 80, the density is this value. It's just the formula that we use. And then we say, okay, it means that at 250, the density is this value, and so forth. So this is the main picture that I have as my tool or the data that I'm using for my machine learning algorithms. That's why I was using convolutional neural networks, these vision-based
images,
tools.
So we're talking about ionograms, right?
Yes, the ionograms are the images of the ionosphere.
Right, so this image is like a 2D height versus frequency map, you said.
I think it's a 5D or 6D image, but it's shown on
superimposed on 2D, is it?
Yeah, so it's like the other dimensions are shown in a different way. So you've got the x-axis showing frequency, the y-axis showing you the height where the signal is reflected, right? But the shape of the you know, the actual chart point, you know, how it is, the size itself encodes the magnitude of the response, okay? So that's another dimension that you can see But there's also the color. Okay, the color tells you the direction from which the echo came. So when I put out a signal, for example, into the ionosphere, it's not. It. I want to know where the reflection came from. Okay, so that is information is recorded using color. Okay, another dimension also encoded using color is what's called the mode of reflection. So there is something called birefringence, which just means that if you have a magnetic field and you have your electromagnetic wave go through a material, right? So imagine a material like we're talking about the ionosphere, for example, right? And then you have an electromagnetic wave going through this ionosphere. Because there is an ambient magnetic field, the wave itself splits into two. Okay, and these have slightly different frequencies. Okay, this is called birefringence, and so these two waves have different modes. That's what it means. They just have two different propagation modes. So yeah, it is a sort of 2D picture in the sense that it's there and 2D flat.
It's giving a lot of extra information.
But yes, so it records that information in color and in shape, in size of the dot or point. You know. So it's a very rich image.
So I wanted to learn more about the antenna, the ionosonde, if I'm saying it correctly.
Yes, the ionosonde.
Yeah. So it needs to be at an open space, is it? Open.
Yes, absolutely. It needs to be an open space.
Do you have any advantage if you do it in Singapore, which is more equatorial compared to other places in the world?
Depending on what you're interested in studying, really, because you're with this instrument, you're really only able to look at your area.
Right? Oh, okay. So the pictures that you get, it's directly on top of Singapore.
Yes, directly on top of Singapore and maybe slightly off as well. But it's really something, you're really getting information about the ionosphere above you. So in order for us to come up with a global picture and do global analysis, people have come up with networks of ionosondes. So there are lots of ionosondes around the world. Like right now, I can go online and look at the ionosonde above some place in Auckland in New Zealand, for example, right?
It's open source, is it?
Sorry?
Is it open source?
Yes, mostly it is. A lot of this information is. It's just that there aren't enough ionosondes around the world, and so some places it's blank. We don't know what's going on there. So it's mostly, you know, in Europe and the US. But yes, once these pictures are taken, there is really nothing too special about it. I don't think there is. I mean, maybe in the future we'll see other, because there are other things that the ionosphere records that, you know, like, for example, the people think that the onset of earthquakes could be recorded in the ionosphere. For sure that it has happened is recorded in the ionosphere, but whether the onset is also recorded there and so forth. But this is data processing, right? How you interpret the ionosondes themselves, what algorithms you build on top of it. But the actual ionosonde itself often is pretty much open source. You can get it online.
So you have this map, right? It's a very rich map. What are you feeding into your network, your neural network? Like what do you want out of it?
Yeah, so I wanted to really, the first part was really a classification task. It was simply, I wanted to look at these images. Initially, I wanted to do it unsupervised in the sense of I give it 30,000 images and I'm saying, okay, there are two types of things here. Okay?
Just try clustering them together.
Yes.
Different classes.
Yes, and I'm telling it that there are only two classes here. Yeah. It didn't work too well. I also tried what are called autoencoders, in the sense of you have an image and you try to recreate the image, right? So like an image of, say, a cat, okay? You put it in a different dimension, in a much lower dimension, mathematically speaking, in a much lower dimension space.
So you encode it, isn't it?
You encode it, and then you decode it to try to create that image. So the idea there was that I give my algorithm or my tool a lot of images that are normal, right? And so it'll get very good at being able to create or recreate the normal images. And then when I give it something that it hasn't really seen, which is the one with the irregularities, it would struggle. Then I would just use some metric, a cutoff threshold to say, okay, if this makes an error of this much, then it's an anomalous image. You should put it in a different category, right?
Yes, sir.
So this was, you know, ideal for me. It would have been the best, right? Because then I can feed it a lot of them. And because normally these ionospheric irregularities are rare on any given day, really. It was a perfect problem for this because it means you, if once you train your algorithm, it just gets very good at encoding and decoding normal images, and then the wrong images are easily identified by the amount of error that this algorithm or model makes. Well, for some reason, it still didn't work. I think the major reason is probably that there is still no clear consensus as to what this irregularity looks like among humans, you know? So, as you know, machines, okay, maybe in the future they'll be more intelligent than us, but right now when you're doing supervised learning, it's supposed to approach you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you are uncertain, okay, if your own accuracy is, I don't know, 70% or something like it, then your model would not, go past that,
yeah.
Right? So it seems that to some degree, you know, of course, this autoencoder was supposed to be automatic, no need for me to come in. But the next step was for me to actually label things. Okay, so I labeled thousands, maybe 28,000 or 40,000. Okay, 28,000.
What's the size of each image? It's 30,000 images. What's the size?
The size is in the kilobytes, really. Okay.
I'm talking about the image size, really.
Oh, 720 by I think 640. You're talking about pixels.
That's fairly big in CNN standards, okay.
Yeah. Actually, no, I brought it down a bit, okay? So when I put in the neural network, I think I had cut it to 300 by 300.
That's small. Okay. That's good enough. Yeah.
So, because I realized that actually all the information I need is still recorded in this smaller version, so there was no need to put in
the original image from the ionosphere as 720 by 640, is it?
Yes, from the ionosonde, of course, from the ionosonde, there is no image. This is
generated from your algorithm and your
No, as in the ionosonde just records voltages and so forth, right?
Yeah.
So this image is kind of
post-processed,
post-color image. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like it's just numbers, and then somebody decided.
Like a heat map of sorts.
Yeah, something like that. As in, it's not a real color image, right?
We give it
these random colors that people chose to say, okay, to record this direction, you should put purple and so forth. So I was hoping it would ignore that part, because the machine obviously took that part into account. But in reality, I would not want the model to look at the color information per se, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes, sir.
That's not what I wanted to, but because that's the nature of it, it looks at everything. So yeah, and ultimately the model that I used was a supervised model where I was really telling it these are the irregularity, these are the ionograms with irregularities and these are the ones without. And so I used transfer learning, which means I took an existing model that was trained on, I think it was 1 million or 10 million plus, ImageNet data set, right? And then I just removed some of the top layers and added my own layers because these existing models were trained for, I think, 1,000 classes or something like that. But I only had two to three classes. And so I modified the model a bit and then just retrained it to fit my case, right?
So you use transfer learning to learn extra features or something like that?
So when I tried to do it using my own, crafted by my own hands, it turned out not to be great, right? So I could not see why, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I decided to go with transfer learning. Mm-hmm. So transfer learning because the initial stages are supposed to identify abstract but very common features, you know what I mean?
Which
so they're not very
translated across different data sets.
So it acts as a feature extractor, the first few layers, and then the top layers should be more and more specific to the problem set. So ideally, you want to remove enough so that it's specific to your case, but of course, the more you remove, the more that you have to retrain yourself. Yeah.
And this model wasn't able to generate its own abstractions? Like if you just give it the different parameters of data, right? Every point means something different, right? Like there's direction,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Yeah.
If you just give it the data, it's not able to generate its own versions of these, like, oh, this type of data means direction, and this type of data means we're looking at a height, for example.
I think it could, right? But it had to be, it has to be programmed, as in I don't know how to extract that information out of it, right? So when for example for the autoencoder part, you know, it's really, I say this is the image, and then what I decide is the number of layers to the point where it is encoding, done encoding, right? So let's say you start, like I said, with a 300 by 300 pixel image. That's 9 2 9 4 zeros, but it's three dimensions also in terms of colors, right? So it's a big, it's a big dimension in terms of space, mathematically speaking. But when I was at the end of the encoder, I just had a 780 dimension sort of say output. Okay, in other words, I had reduced it to 780 dimension, and what that does is it needs to pick out the most important information about the image, right? Because if you have a lot of numbers, you're able to, if you have fewer numbers, you need to be very you need to identify the most important elements of the image and say, okay, this are sufficient to encode all the information that was there in a much higher space, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, there is that kind of picking. The model does identify what the important features are, right? Of course, it doesn't give them a name like we do, like in the sense of this means it's coming from this direction and so forth. This is for us talking to each other as humans. But in a way, it does record information like that, right? The important bits are encoded in the lower dimension of space. But in the end, it seemed that it was not able to give me the values that were satisfactory.
So you said that the Hyunosun gives you voltage and these sorts of readings, and you convert it to an image, and then you use convolutional neural networks.
Yes.
So didn't it strike you that maybe you could use some other form of neural networks and some other forms of data inputs, not necessarily images, but maybe just sending it as normal vectors, for example?
Like, yeah, that's a good question. So the data, you mean the data that is used to create the image?
Yeah, it need not be an image, it could be something else.
Yes, so once you get the voltages, or just numbers, right, in the computer, they become images. That's one direction. But you could also take the numbers directly and do analysis on those, right? Yeah, that was one of the things I was looking into doing until I ran out of time. But it was one area that I and my supervisor had talked about probably exploring as well.
And maybe just to trigger like a open-ended question, so do you think the CNNs were actually outputting something that would make sense maybe later on, several years later, something like that?
Do I think,
I mean, maybe the results aren't making sense because we don't know, I mean, we can't interpret these results or something like that.
Oh, I mean,
maybe the CNN is picking up features, but you know, it's not something which we can think of now.
All right, I mean, that's a possibility, right? Yeah. So, like I say, one of the things that we assumed when you give it, for example, I think you're asking specifically in the case where it's unsupervised, right? So it's probably seeing patterns that I never thought were there.
Yeah.
So once you give you, once you force it to put out two classes, for example, you're assuming that there are only two classes. But in reality, it might see that really there are four classes, right? So you're forcing it to kind of go toward this two class state. So in the future, yes, maybe the other classes that it is seeing would have meaning, you know, in a sense of maybe there is, maybe temperature information is recorded there. So in high temperature images are in one category and so on. But for now, you know, I think that the method of supervised learning is the one that worked the best, and so that's the one that I went with.
And so when you were labeling the data set yourself, what was an example of an anomalous image for you?
Good question. And so the way that I looked at what's anomalous is through training myself, actually, right? So it's not like it's not like one particular characteristic, but what I did was I labeled a few, okay, then I sent it to my supervisor and other folks and said, how are my labels looking, okay, and then they kind of marked me, okay, So it's like one of those, it's like language when you're a baby, right? You don't really know what it is that you're doing right or wrong, but once you get feedback, then you don't do that again, right? So in a way, I cannot pinpoint exactly that this is what makes this what we call an atmospheric irregularity, but I know it, right? I know it because of the labels that I the labeling that I had done. So like I see a lot of dots is one thing, a lot of dots all over the place, okay? It's one thing. But if I see a lot of dots, there could be a lot of dots, but maybe the sizes are not appropriate and so forth, then I say, okay, this is not irregularity and so on. So it's not like one exact thing, it's like the composite image itself. I can say it has a regularity and not, right? So I wouldn't say that I know exactly, you know, it's one of the, like I said at the beginning, it's that I myself probably have an accuracy of 96 maybe, okay? so my, when my models were reaching 89 and 91, I was pretty happy about it. Because it's not like the obvious things like cats and dogs, right? Like it's, or maybe cats and cars, you know, where it's, like the human is kind of 100%, you know, they get things right. So any errors are minuscule. In my case, they were really, in fact, toward the end, I trained another model that had three classes, where there was one with the irregularity, and a class with irregularities, a class without these irregularities, in another class, which I called unsure. I mean, I am unsure, okay? So I put things into these three categories, okay? It helped somewhat, right? But not desirable, because, you know, ideally, when the images come, what I actually, the final output that I want to have is that I have a web interface, which is what I've built. You have a web interface where you as a researcher can upload your ionogram and you can get feedback that it's not, it has a regularity or not, right? In the background, I'm doing this class because I have the model. So in the background, the server side, my model just, you know,
does inference, is it?
Does inference and sends you the response to say it's spread. So the thing is called spread F. The feature is called spread F in the sense of it is spread in the image. So when there is this ionospheric irregularity, for example, okay, so if you put out, let's say, 2 megahertz, okay, the signal that you send up is 2 megahertz, you're expecting it to be only reflected at one point at the appropriate density, okay, in the ionosphere. But when you have this irregularity, sometimes it can be reflected at, you know, 80 kilometers, at 85 kilometers, at 90 kilometers. So what you see on the 2D image we're talking about is it's a longer line. Okay, so it's more spread on this. So on the ionogram, it's not called ionospheric irregularity per se. It's called spread F, as in the PS spread.
Okay. So now that you've done your classification and everything, and you already know the densities of your ionosphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you move?
So
from here,
so the first part really was to put it out to the community, as I mentioned, to build an interface where people can classify their own images, their own ionograms. Okay? And then also I want, because like I said, I am not 100% an expert in the classification or labeling phase. So the interface that I have built allows for people to change the class. Okay. So let's say my model says it is this class. If you're an expert, I want you to be able to change it. And then my model itself should learn over time. Okay? The idea is that as a community, we would actually come with a model that is able to do the classification better than I. Because right now it's just using, so to say, my intelligence and knowledge, right? And my biases. But I want it to be a living model where people can just online, right? Like right now, if you go online, you upload it, and then you really feel like, no, this isn't right, you will change the class of that thing. Those are the main outputs, and then of course what I was also working on was to try to then look at a bunch of these ionograms the last couple of hours and then predict the ionogram for a time in the future and then classify that to say is it an irregularity or not, right? Because knowing after the fact is not too useful, right? If you could predict that there is going to be an ionospheric irregularity, then you can tell folks who could be affected, folks who are using trans-ionospheric communication systems, to say that this magnitude of irregularity will probably, you know, make your signal fade too much. You won't be able to hear probably, and so forth. That was the next step that I did not complete. Okay. Yeah.
Right, yeah. It seems like we're not really sure what the implications are of this moving forward, but what do you think? What do you think people would find out using this kind of, like, if you had a prediction model,
yeah,
right, and it worked to some degree,
yeah,
what do you think would come out of that?
I think the people that are using these trans-ionospheric communication systems, actually, for them, we want to tell them whether they should, what kinds of corrections they should make in order for them to get if their system is going to be affected. We would like to quantify the effect and possibly make corrections, right? This is the sort of the application we're targeting. It's a little bit down the road, because to be able to do it, you need to be very sure about the amount of disruption you're expecting, right? But that's one application area. But generally, the ionosphere itself is just one aspect. Like I mentioned, this is just the density, and it's important for trans-ionospheric communication. But the density itself is also important for just satellites that are moving through the ionosphere. So you might have heard of what's called low Earth orbit satellites, right? These are can be as low as 250 kilometers. It's very low. So what actually happens is the increase in the amount of energy from the sun changes the density. And when the density changes for a satellite, what that really means is that your orbit changes, you know, because let's say that the density changes leads to an increase in drag, right? An increase in drag leads to you coming down slightly, right? So what has happened in some cases is that you come down much more than you had planned, right? A really bad example of it was in 2022, where Starlink, which is a SpaceX company, they lost about 32 satellites because there was a so-called geomagnetic storm, lots of energy from the sun. This increased the density, okay? And that increase in density caused their satellites to come down much faster than their propulsion systems could get them and push them up. So they lost, I think, more than 32 satellites, actually, okay? That is part of space weather, right? And that's part of the goal of my work, to say we want to predict weather so that folks who are operating in space and also through this ionosphere, we can alert them to these kinds of things, to say, okay. Because usually what people do now is they have models, and these models are used to predict the density, right? But as you know, a model usually doesn't take into account these anomalous events, right? Like, that's a model usually is like, it believes tomorrow will be somewhat like today, but not like tomorrow the sun will not rise, you know? It doesn't have that built in. So for those anomalous cases, how do you build a model that's able to be helpful to some degree, to anticipate anomalies as much as possible? So that's what we're expecting. And of course, down the road is that we want to be able to predict the weather if you're going to travel to another planet or to the moon, right? And tell you, okay, the weather report for this travel to the moon is da-da-da-da-da. Maybe you shouldn't leave now, and so forth. So broadly, that's what the goals are for this kind of research.
Right. And so you mentioned that if you're using the supervised learning approach, the person providing the data set is the biggest factor,
yeah,
right, in the accuracy of the model.
Absolutely.
So I have a couple questions regarding that. Do you have, or does the scientific community currently have guidelines on how to label current data?
Not for this specific area, to be honest. So I reached out to a few people, and it seemed that they, you know, like, it's one of those things that you just know. It's like, it's like going to somebody who was brought up speaking English, right? They don't really care about these labels that we use, right, when you're teaching someone. It's like there is no structure. They know how to speak the language, but it's hard for them to express it to you, okay? So it's like I go to these people and they say, no, that's not an ionos. That ionogram doesn't have irregularity, and that one does. And when you ask, like, why is it, then it's like, But that's it. That's, you know, I know it is, right? So right now there are no guidelines. There's nothing written down. So that's why for me, I just went, I labeled, I sent it to my supervisor, then my advisor. And my advisor, she sent the my labeled data set to another person also who would score me. And so from that feedback and a few other folks, I was able to get a picture of, okay, this is what an ionogram should look like. And this is what irregularity ionogram should look like or looks like. It would be good to have that kind of guidelines, but not yet. There is a big booklet that I actually had. Maybe that is a guideline. It just didn't seem like, it didn't seem terribly useful. So I've read this guideline. It just seemed a bit different. It was also, I think, 1960s or 50s when it was made. So it's black and white, and it's like, you know, it just looks like an ancient document that doesn't take into account that now we have color images that encode more information.
Right. So this situation seems like a really good comparison opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to train an unsupervised model,
yeah,
over and over again, and just compare it to, like, at what point it reaches the same classification that you made, right? Then yeah, you would understand that it's on the right track, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if an unsupervised model is able to achieve 96% accuracy somehow,
mm-hmm,
right? Then you know, like, it's found out at least the stuff that I was looking at,
right?
If not more.
Mm.
So was that something you considered?
Well, the thing is that when you tell it to do, when you tell some unsupervised model that there are two classes here, right? It would choose the two most distinct classes, right? But those might not be irregularity and non-irregularity. Those might be distinct in a different sense than what I want. So, for example, if you give it two sets of images where it's cats and dogs, once it gives you two classes, you know it's cats and dogs, right? But if you don't, you know, if that is, if you know that these are the two classes there. But then the thing we'll see, in my case, it will see two classes, but whether those two classes are the one with irregularity and the one without is only true if that's the only distinguishing feature about these ionograms, which isn't the case.
So,
because, for example, there's some taken during the night and some during the day, right? So it might just focus on that and give me those two as the two classes.
So unsupervised networks has, at best, can do clustering, which basically means just divide it into n number of groups. How many groups does you do? And classification is when you actually start naming those clusters as something.
Right.
Yeah, and that then it becomes supervised, right?
Yeah, so I mean, as class, unsupervised classification or unsupervised learning is best if you know you yourself know that there are two classes for sure, right? And so,
since we're not sure, I don't think we can use.
So I think for me, it's like there is an uncertainty around whether there are indeed only two classes and whether the like I said, the difference is, if you know that if there are two classes and the only difference between these two classes that they
is the one that you're seeking.
If the one that you're seeking, then you know that it would give me that. But if there are indeed two, but there is one that's even more glaringly distinct, then it might focus on that instead. So I think that's one of the reasons why this unsupervised one didn't work. But yes, you could train an unsupervised model and then see if it approaches your accuracy as a gauge to say is it heading the right direction.
I remember you were talking about a network wherein you have three classes, one with anomalies, one without, and one in which you were unsure.
Yes.
Did you really force that third class, like the images from the third class, and really force your network to, again, further determine it between those two classes, the one with or without anomalies? Did you try forcing it through and see how much was the error?
Oh, yeah, actually, yes, that's one. That's one of the tests that my advisor asked me to do. So, yes, I did throw in. So I have two classes, and I throw in the unsure ones, and then just look at its accuracy and other metrics. And as far as I can remember, it made some difference. Is that what you're asking?
Was it able to detect, I mean, once you remove that unsure class, was it able to detect with some margin of error the classes again, the top two classes again?
Yes, actually, it always can detect the top two classes because it's like you have three classes, right? And if you don't, you decide to remove the third class, it was taught to look for three classes. It doesn't complain, right? Because you can still say there's this and this. There's no issue there. But what was worth doing and what I did was, you know, if you have these two classes and then you throw in, you know, so you have two classes, let's say the one with irregularity and the one without irregularity, right? Then you have some unsure samples somewhere, okay? You put them aside for now. Once you've trained your model on these two classes, you get an accuracy, let's say 91%, right? If you then bring in these unsure ones from somewhere, right, it should reduce the quality because it's like some pretty unknown thing, right? So it's essentially these unsure ones will fall into either of these two classes. In other words, it should reduce your accuracy, your precision, and so forth, which is what we've saw. So that's why we said, okay, maybe it's worth doing three classes then.
Mm-hmm. Has other research tried to approach this? Let's say they want to look at density in this manner, and how do they kind of go about it?
Yeah, other folks have also used just different kinds of different kinds of algorithms. And, you know, like what's it called again? Trees. What do they call these things?
Decision trees.
Okay. Decision trees.
And random forest.
And random forest. But my work was I started going more in the CNN direction after some papers that came out, I think around 2019 or 2020, where somebody did a comparison between decision trees, CNNs, and I cannot remember the third one.
CNNs, maybe.
Can't remember the third. But out of the three, the CNNs performed the best. On a very similar problem. He approached it slightly differently, but he still used these three algorithms. So I decided that, okay, I would go with the CNNs. But actually, prior to this, CNNs, when I started my research, I started with the, what's called support vector machines. Okay? And these look at the world, you know, somewhat differently, right? And the way that they analyze, the way that they get in data is rather different than how the CNNs look at data. And so, at the end, to me, the supervised the support vector machines didn't work, and then that's when I moved to convolutional neural networks. And then when I first approached convolutional neural networks, I was using this autoencoder structure or architecture, right? And then there, didn't perform too well. That's when I transitioned to, okay, now I'm gonna look at labeling things and then going into the transfer learning to use other people's engineered neural networks as a starting point.
So you went step by step from very rudimentary unsupervised networks all the way up to supervised networks with training.
Yes, I'm not sure if that's the spectrum, but it just happened that, you know, I was learning, because when I started my research, I had zero knowledge about the ionosphere and zero knowledge about the neural networks. Okay. So it's like one day my supervisors were having lunch and like, how about you look at machine learning? So I was like, okay, sure. So, you know, I had to learn the physics, right? It's like my work is physics, you know, but my advisor is, you know, she's very much into physics. Yeah, my advisor works for NOAA, which is a space organization, which is a weather organization in the US, right? So she loves the physics part, right? Yeah. So she was not very happy that my work was, you know, quite light on the physics. It was like a lot of machine learning things. So, but it's like I was trying to learn the physics, and you know, there's like a lot of things that are they're not yet explained, right? So I said, oh my goodness, I'm gonna look at this like a black box. You know, I'm gonna feed it images and then get an answer out, right? So I had to learn the machine learning. So that was like the learning journey. Like I learned about I learned about support vector machines at first. So I said, okay, let me implement that. But support vector machines, you know, they look at when you have a very big image, 780 by 6 or something like that, 700 by 600, you know, and then three dimensions, it was a big vector going big image, in, yeah. Right? And it kind of got lost. So I decided to go toward convolutional nets, because convolutional nets, actually, they look at sections, you know, that's the beauty of it. So you never really have a big thing. You have a big image, but you're going to look at, you're going to be convolving with using very small, what are called convolution kernels.
Speaking of the explaining the physics part and then the black box stuff that you talked about, did it ever occur to you that you could use some... nowadays there are some algorithms wherein you can actually open that black box, as in see why the neural nets choose these specific classes. So did it ever occur to you that you could use some of these black box interpreting techniques?
For sure, I think there is value in understanding why the machine made the choices it made. At the time that I was supposed to be in my thesis, I had run out of time. But I think there's value to it. I mean, honestly, it's just also that to me, I believe that it depends what you're trying to achieve, right?
Yeah.
If your goal is to build a model that can predict, right, not explain, then it's a different ballgame, right?
Because
I was not trying to explain the physics. I was trying to
get you to say, okay, there is
is two things. So likewise, even in industry now, right, if it's very important for you to explain how you came to this answer, then you have to really look at inside the black box. But if your goal is really to detect, you know, the two different classes, then use what really works, you know, and that's it.
Maybe another research topic for another student.
Sure.
Yeah. Speaking of which, how do you see this progressing, like, beyond your project, if someone were to pick it up?
I mean, I want someone to look at it from a density perspective and how it applies to satellites, really. Like I said, mine, maybe the application would primarily lean toward how signals are affected, but I would prefer if someone were to do research in understanding whether these irregularities affect the orbits of satellites, okay? Because that's where I'm transitioning toward now. You know, I'm moving more into the engineering side to be building satellites and so forth, and so I would find a lot more value in that. You know, knowing how I'll be affected, how my satellites will be affected by these irregularities.
So you would want someone to carry on the correlation aspect of this entire thing?
Yeah, I would be happy with that. Practical or more like usable output, you know. It's okay, someone else can work on the physics, but for me, the most needed thing would be the practical side of it. In other words, if it's just correlation, but it's good, it's telling me that something will happen tomorrow, I'm happy with it, right? And then maybe in the future, people can explain why that has that effect on the orbit and so forth.
And would there be value in trying to improve the model itself?
There usually is. In the specific case that I'm dealing with, I think there is still uncertainty around, whether this is the best model, right? Because it is accurate for sure, but I feel that because of my inability to put the things into the appropriate classes, in other words, my own intelligence has this limit. Maybe there might be a better algorithm, right? Maybe a better algorithm that can take that into account better. Because as by design, supervised learning is such that you are the god of the machine, right? It will not surpass you. So I think if there could be an algorithm where my labels, it learns from them, but maybe it's somehow able to improve, right? That would be good to implement.
For sure. Great. So why don't we move into a little bit about you as a person? As I mentioned at the start, you are one of the founders of this very podcast. So I want to pick your brain about that a little bit. How did this idea come about when you guys were just starting out?
I mean, we used to come here, I think it was every Wednesday or every Tuesday, I can't remember. We called it Philoversation at the time, right? And it was supposed to be philosophical discussions about random stuff. So we come here and we sat down and just talked about anything, really. Because we thought that maybe the PH in PhD was not being... there was just no room to explore that philosophical aspect. So we really started with really random things, nothing planned, no structure to it. Of course, after some time, it seemed like we could do better, you know? It seemed like we had the conversation. Some of them were okay conversations. Some of them were great conversations. And we thought, okay, that would have been nice if maybe that were recorded and shared. Or maybe even just for our own reference, like we had this conversation. So by and by, I think Ahmed thought, okay, we could actually formalize this and turn it into a podcast. And together with Muhammad, we said, okay, I think we can actually do this, right? And we thought, okay, instead of just us, which was the case, you know, it's us and a few friends every now and then, and we actually bring people across NTU. And the vision was it would be across, you know, the world down the road, not just at high-end schools, but at anywhere where someone is doing great research that some people somewhere can benefit from. Because you can imagine there are thousands, probably thousands of researchers who can't publish because it costs $1,500 to publish in some journals, right? So, but they're doing incredible work, right? So I'm hoping that in the future we could reach out to those folks, right? They would have a platform such as this as well to talk about their research and potentially find collaborators. But the idea was really to say, you do your work, your day-to-day is what are you doing? And you come here to kind of talk about why you're doing this, you know, like what is the future looking like if you have, once you have succeeded, is these kinds of questions.
Yeah. That's a really interesting activity to be born out of Yunnan Corner.
Yeah.
You don't see too many people here.
Yeah.
At least not for something like this. You
know? Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it was for fun, and that's what we hope it continues to be. We really discourage our guests to come here too prepared. You know what I mean? We really don't want it to feel like it's another conference presentation or whatever, right? We really want to be the opposite of that. We want someone to just freely talk about their research and just have fun. So, of course, you'll be inviting people that perhaps are at this stage, they're writing their theses or they're having struggles, so they might not be smiling and all that, but that was the vision, that they would come here and it would be just a joyful expression of the fun stuff that they're doing. You know, that's what we hope to do, what we hope you guys can get out of the paper.
Yeah, I hope we can carry that forward.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are passionate about the research they do, right? And if we can take some of that out and help them express it, that'd be pretty good for the community. What about you? So you are obviously doing this. Were you doing any other activities during your study?
Yeah, I mean, so besides my research work actually, besides the research physics work, I was also involved in satellite engineering work, right? On some space mission. So this part is really what I'm taking forward to commercialize and set up a company and so forth. But as an individual, I was involved in, you know, TEDx NTU, and I think that was my primary involvement, really. And TEDx NTU was one of the main things that I did, and of course. Not of course, but the other thing I did was to be a residential mentor for undergraduates. And that was an interesting experience as well.
So you must have been pretty busy between that side project, being a residential mentor, and TEDx, and the podcast.
PhD work.
And your PhD work, yeah.
Yeah, look, I realized at the beginning when I came that, you know, many of the things that... you know, in undergrad, I did not read much outside of what I was assigned, you know. I realized that was a mistake, you know. So when I came here, I was deliberately looking at how can I do much more than just what I am supposed to do or assigned to do. You know, as a researcher, this is what you ought to do. So I really was deliberate about that. I tried to interact with people as much as I could because I realized that if I'm just alone most of the time, right? Then there is really no real advantage in coming all the way here, right? Because everything is already online. So I really prioritize interactions with people and learning from other people because there really are lots of really brilliant people here, but they're on their own. And so it's like such great potential conversations that never happen. So all these things, I was really hoping that I would be able to gain from others, but also share with others what I know. So yeah, it was busy, but mostly fun, really, because the interactions were usually you sit with someone for 30 minutes or an hour. If it's an honest conversation, there's so much learning. I enjoyed that very much.
Definitely, yeah, a lot of depth to those types of conversations.
Right.
Like the one we just had right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed you coming on today, sharing your research and your journey with us, really. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and all the best for the podcast.
Thank you. We'll see everyone next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.